This is the time in every presidential campaign when I'm reminded of the grandfather who was importuned by his college-age granddaughter to attend the rally for her political science instructor who had filed for the Congress. And out of love he went, and the instructor spoke at length, and he used all of the jargon and the complicated acronyms of the profession. And when the grandfather returned home, grandmother said to him, "Well, what did you think of him?" "Well," he said, "not too much." He said, "He made me feel dumb at one end and numb at the other." Our political campaigns run entirely too long. Indeed, I'm told that the 1988 campaign has already begun. In England, in Israel, campaigns are begun and ended in a 6-week period. And that seems to me enough of a hardship to impose on anyone whom we want to have the strength and the judgment to occupy a position of importance. Only in America have we turned the organization of political campaigns into a full-time profession. There are hundreds of men, women, in this country who shop around each 2 or 4 years for some candidate who's willing to hire them to manage their campaign. Indeed, I'm quite convinced that it will not be long before some enterprising university begins to give a Master of Arts in presidential management. And you'll be able to take subspecialties in public opinion polls, direct mail advertising, television and media consultation, campaign scheduling, debate coaching, telephone canvassing, speech writing, and issues research. And I'm not really being facetious, because one can make a good living going from candidate to candidate, from campaign to campaign. Campaigns are no longer essentially the coming together of enthusiasts, of disciples, eager for the election of this candidate or that. Indeed, the only telephone conversation I have had about the present presidential campaign was a conversation with a computer who had been programmed to call me up and to tell me of all the heinous activities of the opposition candidate. One of the reasons that campaign financing is such a tricky problem, and probably an insoluble one, is that we Americans have turned it into campaigning into a very expensive, professionalized undertaking. And that in doing so, we have to a very large degree walled off the candidate from the electors. I often wonder what would happen to a candidate who really wanted to get his message out in a full and rounded and shaped form to the American population. Is that his campaign managers would immediately tell him that, well, the audience might listen, but we don't give audiences much credit for an attention span larger than 4 or 5 minutes. And certainly the television cameras wouldn't pick up and report what he had said. The campaigns depend upon television, and television is an entertainment media. And what the television is looking for night after night from the campaigns is a minute or a minute and a quarter of a visual. And what are the visuals that can be reduced to a minute or a minute and a quarter? A panning of the crowd, some picture of protesters' signs, and perhaps a reporter proving that he was there by putting the microphone in the candidate's face and asking the candidate why the polls were showing him to be up or to be down and what that implied for the rest of his campaign. Somebody in the campaign who really wanted to get a serious, rounded, shaped, qualified message across really could not do it in a mass way in our society. Indeed, one of the things that I've noticed about this campaign is it's like so many in the recent past, the candidates are surrounded by plane loads of reporters and cameramen, and you think that they were reporting to us what we needed to know. But in fact, they're reporting to us more about the campaign itself than about the campaigner, more about the superficialities of the campaign than the substance of the campaign. Mr. Mondale was in Cleveland last week. Every one of us knows that he spoke at the Arcade, and the Arcade is a very dramatic scene for a presidential campaign. And every one of us knows that the director of the school board bussed in students from here and there so that there'd be a crowd. And we know that the police cordoned off the area around the Arcade in order to make all of this possible. But I don't think any of us know what the campaigner said at the Arcade that day. And we know that the president took a very expensive trip by train down through parts of western and southern Ohio, duplicating the whistle-stop campaign of President Truman some years ago. And I watched the news that night, and I was told how much it had cost to have special telephones hooked up to that train, and that people whose houses faced the tracks had been removed from their houses by the Secret Service. And I interviewed a local police chief who didn't like what the Secret Service had done. They'd taken over his authority from him. I hadn't the faintest idea what the president said at any one of the places where he spoke on that trip during that long day. Now, the answer, of course, is that what Mr. Mondale said in Cleveland and what the president said in eastern Ohio may not be worth hearing. And there is a certain degree of rationality abroad in the land, which has us going about our work while all this hoopla is going on. But it does, in fact, ensure that the campaign will be largely a matter of trivia, of photo opportunities, of pundits interviewing one another about the consequences of this or that gaffe, or whether or not this or that presidential candidate scored debaters' points in the debates which have now come to be a feature of this campaign. It's too bad, because clearly the question of the governance of a great nation is a weighty and freighted question, and clearly those whom we would want to govern us ought to present to us serious statements of what they in fact mean, what they in fact believe. But we have instead is a campaign which begins with a party platform, a party platform usually written to satisfy all the most excitable and extreme groups within that particular party. The presidential candidate accepts the platform knowing full well that he's not going to abide by it. These are simply ways of satisfying various special interest groups. And then he presents to the country a series, or she presents to the country a series of speeches targeted to specific audiences. Jews are told how much the candidates love Israel. Irish are told how much they would hope for peace in Ireland. The labor unions are told how important domestic content bills may in fact be. Everybody has a speech tailored to their special interests, and everybody knows that the president can't possibly make do on that promise because every promise bumps up against other issues in the campaign. And so what we have is a charade. What we have is a selling, an advertising campaign rather than a presentation of the candidates. What do I think about this campaign? I think it's been anything but memorable. I think that 100 years from now, the 1984 campaign will become part of a trivia contest. What year was it that a woman was first nominated for the vice presidency, and who was that woman? Now, I don't mean to sound fatuous when I say that it's about time that a woman was nominated for this kind of office. And I'd suggest, of course, that this is part of a major change taking place in the American scene. There are 10 women running today for seats in the United States Senate, including one, Nancy Kastenbaum, who is an incumbent. Clearly, women are making their mark in the body politic and increasingly will be seen and elected and become important members of our various legislatures and occupy national offices. But I hope at the same time that this takes place that the women's movement will move away from one of its most egregious claims, and that is that somehow by having women occupy major offices, a new humanity, a new sensitivity will come to the dispensing of power. Politics is a tough game, and only those who are tough manage to rise to the top. And when I look about the women who have broken through, the Indira Gandhis, the Golda Meirs, the Margaret Thatchers, our own Geraldine Ferraro. These are people with iron in their backbone. And they are just as tough and just as tough-minded as the men whom they either replaced or would like to replace. I don't think that we will see necessarily a change in the way governance takes place, because women occupy high office. What we will see is a growing awareness of the needs of women, the needs of family, which will come out of their living experience. But the women who will make it to the top will be just as tough as the men who, by and large, make it to the top. There seem to me to be essentially two kinds of campaigns. Occasionally, there's a campaign which signals a major shift in American public opinion. Most campaigns are simply campaigns which suggest that we haven't quite made up our minds as where we're going as yet. One of those campaigns which signaled a major shift in American opinion occurred in 1960, when President Kennedy was elected. We'd come off as victors in the Second World War. We were coming off a period of great prosperity under the leadership of a benign, grandfatherly general. America felt confident of its power and confident of its prosperity, and they felt it was time to move away from the kind of conservative, let things stay as they were, everything's going all right leadership of Mr. Eisenhower, and to break new ground and to bring youthful leadership to the fore. America could become Camelot. It was a time when, in fact, we thought we could solve most of the problems of the society. If only there was the will and the drive and the energy. It was a time of VISTA and the Peace Corps. It was a time when we felt confident that so much of what we had could be shared broadly and easily with the rest of the world. And the 1960 elections marked a major change in American attitudes and American policies. I think the 1980 election again marked a major change in American attitudes. In 1980, you'll recall, the whole campaign was run out against the background of the hostages being held in Tehran. No one could be confident of American power. Vietnam and the defeat had taken place some years before, but here a group of so-called students was holding the great American power at bay. And the 1980 election took place against a background of what was being called then stagflation, a stagnant economy, double-digit inflation. Americans were worried about themselves. They were no longer worried about sharing prosperity. They were worried about holding on to what they already had. And Mr. Reagan came along and he promised the American people that the answer did not lie with government. Government was part of the problem. The answer lie was in clearing away government intervention, government regulation, so that the American people could, using their well-known initiative and zeal, solve their own problems. We promise them lower taxes, less government interference. And the American people were in a mood, desperately in need of this particular kind, felt they were in the need of this particular kind of approach. And so the 1980 campaign signaled a major change in American opinion. And it's interesting to try to understand exactly the dimensions of that change and why the change took place. Well, one reason for the change had to do with the diminishment of the visible diminishment of American power. Vietnam, the hostages, Beirut. Another had to do with the very visible diminution of American prosperity. What was happening in America, after all, was not different than what was happening throughout the Western world, throughout the industrialized world. And that is that at the end of the Second World War, most of the prosperity of the world rested in the West. And when we built up our plants after the war and we dominated international trade for a number of years, we enjoyed tremendous, tremendous prosperity. And then came the oil crises, and billions of trillions of dollars moved into the Arab world. And then the Third World began to develop its own industrial power. And using the labor, which was obviously much cheaper in that part of the world, they were able to build bars of steel. They were able to develop textiles which could undersell and compete with our own in quality as well as in price. The West was no longer economically as dominant as it had once been. We could not be assured of our prosperity. There was less to go around. And in that intervening 20 years, there had been inflation. People had been hurt. The dollar had lost half of its buying power. And perhaps the most intriguing statistics that have come out of the polls of the last years have been the shift in that part of the population which ought to be the most liberal, the most desiring of change, the young. By 1984, by this year, nearly one-third of the American electorate represents somebody who was born during the so-called baby boom. Now, when they began to poll this younger group, they found some very interesting thing. A Yankelevich poll, which was produced in Time just about 6 weeks ago, found that in the age group between 18 and 24, 63% of those who were interviewed said they were going to vote for Ronald Reagan, and 18% said they were going to vote for Walter Mondale. Of the group 23 to 34, 56% were going to vote for Ronald Reagan, and 29% were going to vote for Walter Mondale. Another poll which went at it somewhat differently, the New York Times CBS poll, found that in 1980, 41% of those 25 to 29 defined themselves as Democratic, that by 1984 that number had been reduced to 36%, that in 1980, 19% of that group defined themselves as Republican, and by 1984, 32% defined themselves as Republican. Now, what's happened? Have the young ceased to have visions, hopes for a grander and better future? I don't know. I do know that there was a wonderful cartoon in one of the papers which shows a couple of counterculture parents in counterculture dress with a youngster in the hand in a three-piece suit and a briefcase. And they're in a doctor's office, and they say, the doctor's saying to them, "Sorry, I've deprogrammed Moonies, and I've deprogrammed Hare Krishnas, but there's nothing I can do with you for Reagan." Why are the young conservative, at least economically? Put yourself back to 1960. In 1960, college cost about a third to a fourth of what it costs today. In 1960, if you got your first paycheck that year, you had only half as much taken out of it as you have today. In 1960, if you dropped out of college, it was rather easy to live by hand to mouth one way or another. You could always go back to college. And if you graduated, there would always be something to do in the society. By 1980, there had been a recession in the late 70s. There would be another one in the early 80s. Jobs were uncertain. College expenses were high. The first paycheck that you received gave you quite a shock, because you had half of the money that you thought you would have as expendable income. And what happened in those intervening years is between inflation and the reduction of job opportunities and the more technical nature of the society, in country after country after country, the young found themselves in a position where life was simply not as easy, not as secure and certain as it had been before. And those programs which of social welfare, which had been begun so confidently at the end of the Second World War and fit in so appropriately with our own sense of what's right and fitting and necessary for a decent and fair society, those programs had multiplied and become, because of inflation and because of professionalization, increasingly costly. And the young felt themselves increasingly burdened by the cost of taking care of the elderly, Social Security, health costs multiplied incredibly, and they saw their futures being mortgaged by all kinds of programs from which they did not get immediate benefit. And everywhere they looked in the 1980s, they began to wonder whether the adult society, the society which had been created, was in fact taking care of them. They were spending a great deal of money to go to school. But were they being educated by the schools? Were they, in fact, getting from the schools the kind of specific skills and training that they required in order to be able to survive, to hold a job in the society? When most of us went out 20, 30 years ago to buy a home, we were able to get a fixed mortgage at 5.5%. The youngsters today who go out to find a place to live find they're paying very high rents, and if they have to buy a place, that they're paying double-digit numbers, and they're not even being guaranteed by the banks that these numbers will remain constant over the period of that loan. Hillel said it a long time ago, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? Which is what the pollsters say when they say people vote their pocketbooks. And though I don't think that the young generation has lost any of the sense of compassion or idealism which dominated in any other generation, there's a certain direct relationship between prosperity and idealism. I do think that they've recognized that there was something in society which they felt had to be stopped, had to end, in order for them to have any chance to have a decent future. Now, whether the way that Mr. Reagan put forward in 1980 and continues to put forward in 1984 is that way is another question. But interestingly, it is Mr. Reagan who has found a way to appeal to an audience you would think he would have nothing in common with. The college age, the young, what they call the yuppies, the young, upwardly mobile professionals, and also the bottom of that group, those who are blue-collar workers or who would like to be. And he's done so, largely rhetorically, he's done so by talking about the Olympic spirit, about clearing away the track from intervention by others so that hard work and merit, in fact, will have their rewards. He's done so by emphasizing America as a place of opportunity where they will not have to bear on their backs the burdens of the past. He's done so by talking about his plans as new and innovative, and Mr. Mondale's as tired and old-fashioned. And somehow he has been listened to. A major change has taken place in American perceptions, like it or not. The Great Depression in 1932 convinced most Americans that the Republican Party was the party of the rich and the powerful and the privileged. They enjoyed 12 years in which they had taken the wealth of the land without any concern for the well-being of the average citizen, and the result had been the end of the prosperity, the Great Depression. The Democratic Party came into this period as the defender of economic opportunity for most people. Government would interfere in order to see to it that the rich could no longer despoil the land, that the wealth would have to be shared, that an income tax would in fact be truly progressive, that there would not be the abuses of speculation which had led to the Depression. The Gallup poll, since 1950, has been conducting a poll which each year asks people, which party do they believe will protect best the economic interests and the prosperity of the United States? And year after year, the majority have said the Democratic Party. This year, in 1984, for the first time in record, a majority of the American people said that the Republican Party was a better defender of the interests, the economic interests of the average American than the Democratic Party. 50% of the Americans said the Republican Party, only 32% of Americans indicated that it was the Democratic Party. Now, what has happened is that in one way or another, the Republicans have been able to tar the Democratic Party as the party of those who spend too much on those on whom money should not be spent. And they have become the party of fiscal responsibility in the eyes of many Americans, and they have become the party which speaks of the need to reduce taxes, to free Americans, to save, to have money for investment, that the basic problem which faces America is to fix up the economic base of the United States, and only then can we deal with the issue that Mr. Mondale holds to be sacred, the issue of fairness, the issue of reaching out to concern to the poor, to those who are left behind, to the semi-literate, and to others. And interestingly, the charge that has been leveled against Mr. Mondale throughout this campaign, the charge that he represents simply, his program represents simply a putting together of the shopping list of all the special interests of the special groups which comprise the traditional Democratic Party, is simply another way of saying that he has not been able to somehow shape these fairness needs into a vision which speaks directly to the American people. He speaks good sense. There's no biblical line. They have eyes, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. You hear only what you are prepared to hear. And the American people are at the moment not prepared to hear the charges that Mr. Mondale levies against this administration for having removed 500,000 fatherless families from the aid-to-dependent children list without thought to the fact they'd be cut off without health care. They might not have enough money for food or for shelter or for heat during the winter. For the moment, at least, Americans are more concerned, or seem to be more concerned, with their own lives and their own needs and survival. Which is to say that the economic situation has tightened for almost everyone, and that the administration, this present administration, found the way to speak of the need to deal with the machinery of the economy, and to deal with these as critically as the first order of business, and to put behind the question of fairness, of social justice, and all these other issues which concern so many of us. Now, if the world continues as it is in fact going, if competition with the so-called industrial world becomes more heated, if government policies across the world are more directed towards bringing in the dollars and the hard currencies that these countries need in order to survive, if we continue to remain dependent upon oil and other such natural resources, one can almost be guaranteed that the economic needs of America will become more and more difficult to satisfy, which is to say that we've all become accustomed to a standard of living which may not be maintainable, and that it is not simply in a country governed by a Ronald Reagan or a Margaret Thatcher, by a government which is determined to cut down the social welfare costs, that these costs are cut down, but in Denmark, in Sweden, in Norway, in countries which are still run by governments of quite a different order, The social welfare budgets are being challenged, and attempts are being made to reduce them. And if you look carefully at Mr. Mondale's campaign statements, if you can find them, because they're difficult to come by, you find that he too is talking of fiscal responsibility. And he has not talked about returning the $60 billion in cuts which the Reagan administration has made in domestic spending to their full extent. At the very most, he's talked about returning half of it. And he's also talked very quietly, but he's talked nevertheless of the need to make further cuts in domestic spending in the years that lies ahead in order to attack the budget and the interest costs and things of this kind. And if you read the material which is coming out of the Brookings Institute, which is the Democratic think tank in Washington, each of the parties has one of these think tanks to which their major bureaucrats go during periods when they're out of office. And you read the reports which were edited this year by Alice Rivlin and others, you find that in terms of the budget, cuts in domestic expenditure, the need to balance the budget, you have almost a mirror copy of some of the things which Reagan and his people have been saying. I'm convinced that if these cuts were made by the Democratic Party, by Mr. Mondale, they would be made quite differently and with much more empathy and concern for the consequences than they have been done by this administration, which is to some degree mean-minded. But nevertheless, the issue is real. And economy has become again the dismal science it was known to be in the 19th century, how to divide not enough among too many. And it's interesting that Mr. Reagan has been able to maintain his position as the great, as the man who will control public spending, despite the fact that in 1980, 22.4% of the gross national product was being spent by the federal government, and by 1984, 25% of the gross national product was being spent by the federal government. Because he has combined this demand for domestic cuts with the demand for massive increases in defense spending. But again, I would remind you that a president proposes and Congress disposes. And if he had not been able to secure the assent of Congress to this massive increase in defense spending, that defense spending would not have taken place. He doesn't have the billions of dollars that are required. The Congress alone can allocate these. And what is in fact true is that the great debate over the expenditures for military hardware and for the military forces, which has taken place in this last few weeks, has not been between Mr. Mondale saying we've got to cut the 200 plus billions of dollars spent annually for defense spending by 20% or some figure such as that, but between a Mr. Mondale who says we should increase defense spending only 4% and Mr. Reagan who says it must be increased 7%. They've argued over the B-1, they've argued over the MX missile, but the idea that the cost of the Defense Department must be maintained and in fact increased is a common theme which runs through both of these parties. So that the option, which an opposition party might have had in this election, which is to say we can provide for some of these domestic costs by cutting drastically into the defense budget, has been one which has not been taken up by the Democratic candidate. And I think, and to a very large degree, wisely so. And to do this, Mr. Mondale rebuffed the advice of the left wing, the Jesse Jackson wing of his own party, which sees the future of the world lying in the third world and looks upon all military matters largely in terms of an unnecessary expenditure. We have really no need to use military power either as a deterrent or as a means of expanding or maintaining our own interests. But clearly a majority of the American people, and certainly both presidential candidates, are committed to American strength. Those of you who listened, as I did carefully, to the last of the two presidential debates heard Mr. Mondale talk of military strength more strongly than really Mr. Reagan. Now, I think he would go about dispensing strength in a different way. He would have a different mix in the military. He would be probably more willing to combine negotiations and political maneuvering with brandishing the sword. But at the same time, there isn't a great deal of difference between the approach, as far as a budget is concerned, to the military problem. Which brings us really to the question, what is it that a president can do? What are the limits of effective presidential power? And the answer is a strange one. It's a paradoxical one. On the one hand, the president is one finger away from destroying mankind. He shares with Mr. Chernenkov the red button. He shares the ability to destroy mankind by a decision. But on the other hand, that apart, the president is part of a government deliberately created to maintain a series of very complicated checks and balances. And in almost no area is his power unfettered. He has the power to nominate a man or woman who might be the next president of the United States. Once the candidate is nominated, it is usually the candidate who nominates the vice president. He has the power of nominating the federal judiciary, but the Senate must advise and consent. And as Mr. Nixon found in the case of Mr. Carswell, the Senate does not always advise and consent. He has the power to appoint about 800 to 1,000 senior people who occupy authoritative places in government. But most of these people will be given responsibility in one cabinet area or another, and the work of those bodies is largely determined now by a bureaucracy which is as professionalized and entrenched as the English bureaucracy, and that they can deliberately prevent a person from doing a great deal if they approve, disapprove, or they can encourage certain programs that they approve of. So even these senior advisors have limits on what can be accomplished. As far as the federal budget is concerned, he must get the assent of Congress. And that's increasingly difficult as Congress has become an increasingly open body, no longer dominated by a few people who could be called to the White House because they controlled their committees and everything could be worked out in the Oval Office. The president's real power, I submit, lies in the area of foreign policy. Now here, of course, there are limits. After Vietnam in 1973, we established a War Powers Act, which said that if the government, if the administration puts in troops into one area or another, he must submit his actions to the Congress, and if they are not affirmed within 60 days, he must withdraw these troops. But beyond this, and beyond the fact that any commitments he makes must be funded by the Congress, it is a president who really works out the atmospherics, who works out the details in which various negotiations take place. When a president is determined to achieve a given end, as let's say President Carter was at Camp David, he stays with that program until it is in fact achieved. Now, each of these men obviously has a very different style in going about the issues of foreign affairs. Mr. Reagan has, to his credit, I think, managed to reestablish the idea that America is not only a powerful nation, but is a nation which in certain conditions will use that power, which is to statement that we are in fact powerful. He was able to stand firm despite the growth in Europe of very strong pressures against the establishment of the cruise and Pershing missiles on the European continent because the Russians had already established their missiles in the Warsaw Pact nations. He's clearly a man who likes to talk belligerently. He's clearly a person who thinks in terms of which are relatively simplistic. Mr. Mondale's judgments, and he's an experienced person, I think I tend to be calmer, more judicious. At the same time, he is a man who comes out of a party which, by and large, has not yet come to grips with what power means, American power means in the post-Vietnam era. And so, the president will make decisions. We cannot be sure in what area these decisions will have to be made. We cannot be sure of the wisdom of the decisions he makes. And ultimately, the choice we make of a president is really the choice of how he will come down in those few ultimate moments when issues of consequence are put before him. And you've got to cut through all the position papers and all the scenarios and decide this should be done and this should not be done. And that, of course, is a decision each and every one of us must ultimately make in the privacy of our own souls. Let me end by asking and answering very quickly a simple question. Is there a Jewish issue in this campaign? And if you mean by that, is there one side or another side which will be more favorable to Israel? The answer is no. Each side will be erratic in its actions vis-a-vis Israel. Both Mr. Mondale and Mr. Reagan understand that Israel is a democracy, understand its strategic importance in the Middle East, understand the long traditional commitments of the United States to Israel. Both men also understand the importance of the Arab world and the importance of oil and the dependency of the Saudi Arabians on Western support, and each of them also understands the conflicting interests of the European nations in the Middle East. And so there will be times, whoever elected, when they will be supportive of what we think is important for the survival of Israel, and there will be at times, whoever is elected, where they will take actions which we will feel will not be as supportive of Israel. I must confess that I'm less sanguine about Mr. Bush than about any of the other of the four people who are up for election. His record, as far as Israel is concerned, is not one which makes me feel that he would have an instinctive sympathy or patience with the problems of the state. Is there an issue for American Jews in this election? There are many issues. Many issues. And the issue for us is the issue that faces all Americans. Is our first priority somehow our own immediate economic advantage, a party which promises us that they will somehow put the economy right, and do we believe that they have the formula which will in fact do so? Or are we committed to a standard of social justice, concern for the handicapped and the poor, for all the people who are part of other America, and we feel that we can still maintain those concerns, pay for them, and maintain a degree of prosperity within the nation? And do we believe that the other party has the formula which will allow the nation to recover some of its prosperity? And that's a decision each and every one of us will have to make. That's a decision that we will depend upon our own economic understanding, our own political commitments, our own ideologies. It's not an easy one to make this time, because I am not for one convinced that either party can guarantee prosperity. I think the tides of history are running against the West when it comes to the West being able to maintain the standard of living which was the outgrowth of colonialism and imperialism. I think we can see that in our relationships with the rest of the world, that they are now effective competitors with us, not only in the production of basic materials, but in the production of very sophisticated electronic and technical materials. And I think Americans are going to have to get used slowly, but get used to the fact that we are a country which has enjoyed it, which has enjoyed its greatest measure of prosperity. And now we're going to have to become a country which will admit that it is one with everyone else in the world. Powerful, strong, productive, but not able to sustain for any part of its society that life of excess, which has really been a mark of American society over the last 30 years.